I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Hey there, history fans. We're taking the day off, but don't worry. We've got plenty of classic shows to tide you over. Please enjoy these flashback episodes from the TDI-HC Vault. Hello, and welcome to This Day in History class, a show that believes there's no time like the present to learn about the past. I'm Gabe Lousier, and in this episode, we're talking about a kidnapping in Greece that went from bad to worse the more the government got involved. The day was April 11th, 1870. Lord Muncaster of Britain and four other tourists were captured in Marathon, Greece by a gang of outlaws. The Greek pirates, or brigands, later demanded a £50,000 ransom for the release of the hostages, which included Lord Muncaster and three other British aristocrats, as well as an Italian nobleman. When the King of Greece flatly refused the demand, the kidnapping quickly spiraled into a major international incident, with Britain even threatening war. Jocelyn Pennington, aka Lord Muncaster, was a British soldier and Conservative Party politician with a seat in the House of Lords. In 1870, he embarked on a tour of Europe with his wife, Lady Muncaster, and six other traveling companions. They arrived in Athens, Greece, in early April, and on the morning of the 11th, they set out on a day trip to the site of the Battle of Marathon. It was a 25-mile journey by carriage through a mountainous region that was a notorious haven for bandits. As a precaution, the group's carriages were escorted by four mounted police and 12 foot soldiers. However, on their way back, the carriages got ahead of the marching soldiers and were ambushed in a ravine by about 20 armed brigands. Two of the mounted police were shot and killed, and the travelers were then forced out of their carriages and led deep into the mountains. A little while later, Lady Muncaster and the two other women in the party were released, along with the two surviving policemen. This group of five was sent to deliver the brigands' ransom demands to the Greek government, while Lord Muncaster and the other four hostages remained behind. While they waited, Muncaster and the other hostages negotiated with their captors, eventually convincing them to lower the ransom from 32,000 English sovereigns to £25,000, the equivalent of more than £1.5 million today. In addition, they also wanted amnesty for their entire group. With a new set of terms decided, Lord Muncaster was sent after his wife with the updated proposal, and the bandits' hostage count dwindled to just four. The kidnappers were led by Takos Arvanitakis, and they were no strangers to capturing and ransoming tourists. And since they were such seasoned pros, they were reportedly pretty laid back about the whole thing, at least as far as captors go. For example, Frederick Viner, the youngest of the hostages at 23, is said to have joined his kidnappers in several competitions, including foot races and boulder tossing. However, once the ransom demands were delivered to the Greek government, the positive mood soured fast. The government agreed to pay the bandits £25,000, but they said amnesty was not an option under Greek law. When the brigands heard how readily the ransom was accepted, they concluded that their hostages must be relatives of Queen Victoria, and were therefore worth an even larger sum. So with amnesty off the table, the kidnappers decided to go for broke and up their demand to £50,000. Queen Victoria followed the negotiations closely and was annoyed by how long it was taking the Greek government to deal with a simple gang of bandits. This put King George of Greece in an awkward spot. He didn't want to establish the precedent of giving in to kidnappers, but he also didn't want England to think that he wasn't doing everything possible to free their citizens. Trying to save face on both accounts, the king made a somewhat misguided compromise. He refused to pay the £50,000 ransom, and instead offered to exchange himself in return for the hostages. Of course, the brigands wanted money, not more hostages, and especially not one with as much heat as a king. They rejected the offer, and negotiations came to a standstill. At that point, about a week into the ordeal, the Greek government decided to try a more direct, but no less misguided, tactic. It dispatched a group of soldiers to Dalessi, the coastal town in eastern Boeotia, where the hostages were being held. The troops tracked down the bandits, surrounded their hideout, and prepared to lead a daring rescue. They had been instructed not to shoot unless first fired upon themselves, but when the soldiers sighted the brigands, some of them immediately opened fire. In the ensuing panic, some of the brigands were shot and others were captured, but most, including Arvanitakis, managed to escape. As for Frederick Viner and his three fellow hostages, they were all shot dead amidst the confusion. It's unclear whether they were killed by their captors or by the friendly fire of their would-be rescuers, but either way, it was the worst possible outcome for nearly everyone involved. The ugly incident became known across Europe as the Dalessi Massacre, and both the British Parliament and the Queen herself condemned the Greek government for its botched response. As public outrage grew, England began to threaten war with Greece unless the country cracked down on its bandit problem. Greece complied, and several of the bandits involved in the kidnapping were arrested, tried, and executed. Arvanitakis was eventually killed as well, and the number of kidnappings in the country drastically declined in the following years. These actions alone probably would have been enough to ease international tensions, but it didn't hurt that Russia came to Greece's defense. The prospect of taking on both nations at once put everything in perspective, and England's talk of war quickly ceased. Several months after the Dalessi massacre, a photo titled "The Seven Heads of the Greek Brigands" began to circulate across Europe. The stereoscopic photo showed the severed heads of seven executed bandits, which had been put on public display in Athens earlier that year. When viewed through a stereoscope, the image appeared in 3D, making it seem like the men's heads were right in front of you. According to the letter of the law, the brigands' punishment was justified. But by immortalizing their suffering as a gruesome souvenir, the public demonstrated the same inhumanity as those who would bargain for men's lives. I'm Gabe Lousier, and hopefully, you now know a little more about history today than you did yesterday. You can learn even more about history by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at TDIHCShow. And if you have any comments or suggestions, you can always send them my way at thisday@iheartmedia.com. Thanks to Chandler Mays for producing the show, and thank you for listening. I'll see you back here again tomorrow for another day in history class.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Hello and welcome to This Day in History Class, a show that hits the high notes of history every day of the week. I'm Gabe Lussier, and today we're celebrating Barbershop Quartet Day with a look at the story of the first group devoted solely to the nostalgic cause of barbershop music. The day was April 11th, 1938. The first meeting of the Barbershop Harmony Society was held in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was organized by Owen Clifton Cash, a local tax attorney, and by Rupert Hall, an investment manager. A few weeks earlier, the men's paths had crossed in Kansas City, where they discovered they had a common interest in barbershop music. The two discussed the idea of holding some kind of festival or meeting for fans of the waning genre to get together and practice their craft. They got the ball rolling by inviting 14 male singers to gather at the Tulsa Club that spring. They weren't sure anyone would actually come, but in the end, it was a full house. There were even about a dozen extra men who had been brought along as guests. The following week, 70 men showed up for the second meeting, and attendance continued to grow from there. What had started as an informal organization eventually became an official one, complete with officers, charters, and bylaws. The society helped revive interest in barbershop quartets throughout the 1940s, making it socially acceptable once again for four men to don striped jackets and straw hats and sing together in perfect harmony. So if you've ever seen the Dapper Dans perform at a Disney theme park, now you know who to thank for helping keep that style of music alive. For the uninitiated, barbershop music is a popular form of choral a cappella singing. The focus is on tight, carefully arranged harmonies between four, typically all male or all female, singers. In male groups, the second tenor generally acts as the lead, carrying the melody with which the other three voices harmonize. The first tenor sings harmony above the lead, the baritone sings harmony below, and the lowest voice, the bass, sings lower still, providing the foundation. Other common characteristics of the genre include the synchronization of word sounds, the repetition of phrases to produce an echo effect, and the use of music with a strong syncopated rhythm, such as ragtime. The roots of barbershop music are somewhat more diverse than you might expect. Although the musical style is generally associated with the United States, its name likely came from England. As far back as the 1600s, British barbers kept a stringed instrument on hand for their customers to strum while waiting for their turn in the chair. Some of the regulars would even rig up other instruments to flesh out their performances. One popular trick was to fill a candlestick with coins and then shake it to add a bit of percussion. The resulting songs became known as barber's music, or more simply, as barbershop. The marriage of music and haircutting eventually made its way to the US, and by the 1830s, barbershops had become the social and musical centers for average Joe Americans. In their case, though, the communal instrument of choice was their voices. Sometimes it was the barber himself who would lead things off, singing a tune to pass the time as he worked. Then, some of his patrons would inevitably join in by adding their own harmonies to the mix. Those impromptu songs usually took the form of call and response, a compositional technique that was brought to the US through the music of enslaved Africans. By the late 19th century, the American family unit had become quite musical, thanks to the spread of printed sheet music and to the presence of a piano in most middle-class homes. Those conditions allowed barbershop-style singing to catch on outside of the barbershop, and in the years ahead, it became a full-blown national craze. Although the exact origins are unknown, most music historians believe the barbershop style grew directly from the African-American music of the 1880s and 1890s. Many black communal folk songs of the era share qualities with barbershop, especially spirituals, which place a heavy emphasis on timing, intonation, and of course, the blending of voices. White minstrel singers began imitating that style, and in the early days of the recording industry, white quartets started recording and selling albums that showcased their vocal harmonies. Some of the first hit barbershop songs later became genre-defining staples, such as Shine On, Harvest Moon, Hello My Baby, and Sweet Adeline. That last title will come up again a little later, so for now, let's listen to a clip from a 1904 recording of the song by the Hayden Quartet.
Sweet Adeline, my Adeline, at night, dear heart, for you I pine. In all my dream, your fair face be.
If you formed a picture in your mind while listening to that song, it probably involved four guys dressed in bright striped jackets and straw hats, and maybe some big mustaches too. That signature look became synonymous with the genre at the turn of the 20th century, when barbershop quartets were fixtures of the vaudeville circuit. The singers would typically take the stage in between the other acts, while the curtains were drawn and the next performers were setting up. The quartet's flashy costumes and oversized facial hair were a way to ensure that they could be seen by all the patrons, even the ones way back in the cheap seats. The distinctive sound and look of barbershop quartets remained in vogue until the 1920s or so, at which point it was eclipsed in popularity by jazz and swing. However, a decade later, harmony singing was still limping along in some places. For example, it was featured fairly often in early theatrical cartoons. In fact, one of my personal favorite uses of barbershop was in the 1934 Merry Melodies short, Pop Goes Your Heart. In it, the song of the same name was performed by the Guardsmen Quartet. Take a listen.
Quite unexpectedly, a lovely face you see, and suddenly pop goes your heart. Without a warning word, a charming voice is heard, and suddenly pop goes your heart. When life is just a bowl of withered fruit, so sour and dry, you just want to cry. Then presto change, you're in love, and life's a cherry pie.
Outside of cartoons, barbershop was still alive in many American homes as well. It was no longer the popular music of the day, but for many men in particular, barbershop was still their preferred form of musical self-expression. Owen Cash and Rupert Hall were among those faithful adherents, and in the spring of 1938, they decided to get together with their fellow diehards. They sent out a somewhat tongue-in-cheek invitation to that effect, writing, quote, "Gentlemen, in this age of dictators and government control of everything, about the only privilege guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, not in some way supervised and directed, is the art of barbershop quartet singing. Without doubt, we still have the right of peaceable assembly, which I am advised by competent legal authority includes quartet singing. The writers of this letter have for a long time thought that something should be done to encourage the enjoyment of this last remaining source of human liberty." The letter went on to set the time and location of the first meeting, Monday, April 11th at 6:30 p.m. at the Tulsa Club, an all-white, all-male social club that served as a popular venue for high-class dinners and meetings. The invitation was signed, quote, "Harmoniously yours, Rupert Hall, the Royal Keeper of the Minor Keys, and O.C. Cash, Third Assistant Temporary Vice Chairman." Those self-applied titles were meant to sound ridiculous, and so was the name of the organization they claimed to represent, the Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in America, or SPEBSQSA. Of course, once the organization was formalized, it dropped the silly name and adopted the much more sensible one of the Barbershop Harmony Society. Hall and Cash had reserved the club's rooftop garden for their first meeting, and the group spent most of the evening out there singing old songs beneath the stars. The men had so much fun, they agreed to meet again the following week. Unfortunately, some Tulsa Club members on the floors below had complained about the hours-long singing session, so the group had to relocate to a nearby hotel. By the end of May, their now weekly meetings were drawing upwards of 150 men, and the group was fast outgrowing its new venue. The decision was ultimately made to start setting up other chapters outside of Tulsa. The first of those offshoots was started in Oklahoma City that July, and was soon followed by groups in Kansas City, St. Louis, and four other Oklahoma towns. In the decades that followed, chapters were added in other states as well, fulfilling the dream of a wide-scale barbershop revival. However, it wasn't a very inclusive revival. Membership to the Barbershop Harmony Society was open only to white men, just like the Tulsa Club where the group was founded. The organization finally opened to men of color in 1963, but it remained closed to women of any ethnicity until 2018. Of course, that's not to say that women interested in barbershop had just been sitting on the sidelines waiting for permission. In fact, many of the wives of early BHS members actually started a similar organization for women way back in 1945. As a nod to an old barbershop standard, the group called itself the Sweet Adelines, though after nearly 80 years of expansion, it's now called Sweet Adelines International. Both groups are still going strong in the 21st century, with the BHS now boasting more than 800 chapters and well over 20,000 members. When you factor in Sweet Adelines International and other affiliated groups, the total number of active barbershop singers is estimated to be more than 80,000 worldwide, representing more than 30 countries. The mission and motto of these groups is "Harmonize the World." That's a demanding task for anyone, especially these days. But who knows? Maybe barbershop singers will be the ones to pull it off. In our current climate, it's the kind of ludicrous idea that just might work. I'm Gabe Lousier, and hopefully, you now know a little more about history today than you did yesterday. If you want to keep up with the show, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at TDIHCShow. And if you have any comments or suggestions, you can always send them my way by writing to thisday@iheartmedia.com. Thanks to Chandler Mays and Ben Hackett for producing the show, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you back here again tomorrow for another day in history class.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.